Well, the topic is idols. There's a lot of verses in Jeremiah and elsewhere about idols. But considering my audience and where you just were, I'm wondering if the most important idol passage might not be Titus chapter 1. Idol gluttons. Different word, idol. All right. The structure in the prophetic messages, you can go through most of the prophets and break down most of the statements into one of the following categories, the important things that need to be said. You've got declarative statements like, thus saith the Lord, election statements, reminding them what God had done for them, rebellion statements, this is how you behave, exhortation statements, you need to then do the right thing, judgment statements, here's what's going to happen if you don't, compassion, return, messianic, etc. And so, of course, our statements we're going to be looking at in this lecture are going to be the rebellion statements, and particularly the rebellion statements about the problem that they had with idolatry. And, of course, here we are down here at the time of about to go into captivity, and that's his part of his message, is you're going to be judged for that. And he brings up that they have violated the covenant that goes way back up here. And if we look at the Ten Commandments, the first 2 out of 10 are about this very topic. He brought them out of Egypt. Let's turn back there, Exodus chapter 20. He brought them out of Egypt. And in the Ten Commandments, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Number one, you shall have no other gods before me. Number two, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness or anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, etc. Well, of course, Moses will come off the mountain, and what are they doing? You know, here's what brought you out of Egypt, and they've got an image right there, and it continues to be a continual problem. And I'm going to put a number of statements up here about idolatry. I'm going to go through them pretty quickly, but I want to make a point in doing that. Chapter 1, what do you see? He sees the boiling pot facing from the north. He said, out of the north, disaster is going to come. Why? Because they're evil and forsaken me, they have made offerings to other gods and worshipped the work of their own hands. Chapter 2, I brought you into a plentiful land to enjoy its fruit and good things. But when you came in, you defiled my land and made my heritage an abomination. The priest did not say, where is the Lord? Those who handled the law did not know me. The shepherds transgressed against me. The prophets prophesied by Baal and went after things that do not profit. Later in chapter 2, how can you say I'm not unclean? Look at your way in the valley. Know what you have done. In fact, he compares them to this wild donkey in the wilderness, in her heat sniffing the wind. Who can restrain her lust? None who seek her need weary themselves to find her. That's how available they're being. Jeremiah chapter 2 on this, the topic of shame. As a thief is shamed when caught, Israel shall be shamed. And it says, where are your gods that you made for yourself? Let them arise if they can save you in your time of trouble. For as many as your cities are your gods, O Judah. He says, you have the forehead of a whore. You refuse to be ashamed. How many of you have ever dealt with a woman that was in adulterous relationship or pursuing an adulterous relationship, and you're trying to talk sense to them, and there's just this absence of shame, this just kind of defiance? You have the forehead of a whore. You refuse to be ashamed. Jeremiah chapter 3. She sees that all for all the adulteries of that faithless one Israel, I had sent her away with the decree of divorce, the older sister in the north, yet her treacherous sister Judah did not fear. She too went and played the whore. Jeremiah chapter 3, 23. Truly the hills are a delusion, the orgies on the mountains. Dad talked before about the sexual involvement. We'll talk a little bit about that further on here. There's something fitting here. as you have forsaken me and served foreign gods in your land, so you will serve foreigners in a land that is not yours. Chapter 7, if you will amend your ways, if you do not go after the other gods to your own harm. That was one of the texts that varies between, if I remember correctly, between the Dead Sea Scroll manuscript and the other one. Jeremiah 7, 9 through 10, will you steal, murder, and this we can think about within our own lives and in the people that we're dealing with, in the responsibility we have not to be hypocritical and come before God. Look at this. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal, and go after other gods that you've known, and then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered, only to go on doing all these abominations? Like First John chapter 1, where it talks about those that claim to have fellowship with the Lord, but what? Walk in darkness. Jeremiah chapter 7, do not pray for them. Do you see what they're doing in the cities of Jerusalem, Judah, in the streets of Jerusalem? Look how the whole family's involved. The children gather the wood. The fathers kindle the fire. The women knead the dough to make cakes for the queen of heaven. They pour out drink offerings to other gods. They have set their detestable things in the house called by my name. And then there's reference to in the valley of the sons of Hinnom to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire. The bones of the kings of Judah and the officials, the priests, etc., they're going to be brought out of their tombs and they're going to be spread out before the sun and the moon and all the hosts of heaven, which they have loved and served, which they have gone over and which they have sought out and worshipped. And their carved images and their foreign idols, because they have forsaken my law that I set before them and have not obeyed my voice, but have stubbornly followed their own hearts and have gone after the Baals, or Balaam, as their fathers taught them, I'll scatter them among the nations. We'll look at this passage in detail in a few minutes, Jeremiah 10, about learn not the ways of nations. And though they cry to me, I will not listen to them. So then they're going to go and cry to the gods who make offerings, but they cannot save them. Your gods have become as many as your cities, Judah, and Jerusalem. Your altars are as many as your streets. And when they say, why has the Lord pronounced all this great evil? We as people have a remarkable ability to justify ourselves and rationalize our behaviors and such. No matter what we're doing, people tend to think that God is on their side. When I lived in Europe, I picked up some stuff from World War II and foreign stuff. You know what the Nazi belt buckle said during World War II? There's a swastika in the middle. You know what it says around it? Gott mit uns, God with us. You know, so people can do anything they want. Is it, oh, God's with us. Why is Lord, because your fathers have forsaken me and gone after other gods and served and worshiped them. Here's the reference, you've polluted my land with the carcasses of your detestable idols, your altars and your ashram that we'll talk about in just a minute. He tells them, go buy a potter's earthenware flask. Take some of the elders of people and some of the elders of priests, go out in the valley of the son of Hinnom, make offerings to it, to the other, where they've been making offerings. Jeremiah's not being told to that. Filled with this place of the blood of innocence. It needs to break it. So take this earthen, you know, break it and say, is this going to be able to put back together again? You know, you're not going to be able to patch that up. And it's the disaster coming. Well, of course, then Pasher, who is the chief officer there at the temple, takes Jeremiah, beats him, and puts him in stocks until the next day. I want you to stop and just envision that for a minute and think about this picture. You're an inhabitant of Jerusalem or from Judah, and you're in Jerusalem that day. You go, there's the temple. Here is some foolish-looking person in the stocks over here. I imagine most of you have been to a place like Williamsburg or something where they've got the stocks to show you what it was like, and you know how people treated people that were in the stocks. So here's this fellow that's been beaten, and he's in the stocks. Who did it? Why, Pasher, the priest, the chief officer of the temple. And so as you're walking through, what's it real easy to conclude who's right and who's wrong here? Who's the nutcase and who's out of line? Who's to be reviled? Who's not to be listened to? Here's the temple. Here's the priest. And we need to remember that when we're having to deal with things. And there's going to be some times if we stand up for what's right, we're going to be the ones that are ridiculed, the ones that are mocked, or the ones that are run out of town or something like that. And all of these people, oh, don't listen to him. But the lesson, of course, is about who is being faithful to God. Jeremiah 25, 1 through 11. Even as your fathers forgot my name for Baal for 23 years. And this is one of those that's, I couldn't find the Dead Sea Scroll and checking on them, but I might have missed it because I was doing it over the phone. This is in Septuagint, though, and in the Masoretic text. For 23 years, I've spoken persistently to you, saying, turn now every one of you from his evil way and deeds. Do not go after the other gods to serve and worship them. And then this is in all of them. Yet you have not listened to me that you might provoke me to anger with the apparently O works of your hands. Sorry about that. And then, of course, it's going to be predicted that the 70 years, there's going to be the 70 years of captivity. Now, how many of you want me to put up many, many, many more verses about idolatry? help me out, Mike. Say no.
No, we don't want to.
All right. We're ready to hear something else, right? Because we've seen a lot of verses. You've seen 23 slides denouncing idolatry. Instead of a slide, make each of those a year. Up to this point in Jeremiah's career, he spent 23 years at this point calling them to stop forsaking God and stop serving idols. They're borrowed gods. We have, of course, reference here and throughout Scripture to Baal and Balaam. Often in the Old Testament, fertility god, storm god, king god, Encyclopedia Britannica. Jewish Encyclopedia says it's the sun god of the Babylonians. He's related to El. By the way, you'll see Baal has to do with possessor or lord. You'll see it used in different connotations. In places and different things. And in some things, there's Baal, and then there was another god, El. And, of course, you think about Elohim and stuff. You come to the New Testament, and what's the Greek word for God? Theos, which what word would the Greeks have used to describe their gods? So you've got a basic word for God in El and a basic word for Lord in Baal, but it's these lords out there that are these false lords that are being followed by the people, and there were many of them. So as many as are your cities, O Judah, you know, are your gods. And so Baal, yeah, is basically this fertility god, and I appreciate the comments made before about, and thought about that you've got of people that used to be shepherds coming in, and now they got to do farming, and of course we know just a lot of the cross influence was very problematic. The Asherim, goddess associated with Baal, statue near to the altar of Baal, like in Judges, you have someone chopping down the Asherim. It would often be a wooden pole next to that representing some consort, female deity. You have the Queen of Heaven, Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 18, and this is from ISBE. It seems probable from the cakes that are offered, she is to be identified with the Assyrian Ishtar, the Canaanite Astarte. You've got the sacrifice of children in the Valley of Hinnom, which was going on. Different places around the Mediterranean. I remember seeing one illustration where, this was just an illustration, but in this one, the hands were this way, and it would go, maybe in other ones were this way, but they would lay the child there, and then it would fall into the fire. And I appreciate the comments made before about how, if we think back, how could people possibly have done that? But you look at things that are being done in our culture today. And in our culture today, it really, woe to those who call good evil and evil good. You know, if you're against abortion, you're an evil person. And if you, really right now, the mark of an evil person is someone who does not favor homosexual marriage. The mark of a good person is someone that not just tolerates, but, you know, celebrates and wants to stand up for that. Our culture is getting more and more corrupt. And whatever culture you're in, like, have you ever read 1 Corinthians and just wondered, you know, what's going on here? Well, they were in the middle of Corinth. And so even though in one instance they've kind of outdone the Corinthians, they're Corinthians. And in the Corinthian culture, a lot of that, it just comes from their culture. And we're called to be different than our culture. The carnality, look at Jeremiah chapter 3. Look at these passages real quick. Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 23. truly the hills are delusion, the orgies on the mountains. Over in Hosea, it talks about a text that may be a reference to this in 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 7. There's obviously sexual activities going on there. Baal being a fertility god, you can see how some of the connections. And it's all males in here, so like if they wanted rain, kind of a sympathetic magic pagan thing, ejaculations were thought to be, symbolic of or calling for rain and different stuff. So you had just these orgies, and besides just the nonsense of it and the paganness of it, you've just got the carnality of it. If you go out here and you invite people to come to a Bible study, there's a lot of people who are not going to be interested. If you go out here and invite people to something filthy and carnal, there's a lot of people who'd be interested. And Israel is surrounded by this, and it's become contaminated, and so they're willing to kill their children. They're willing to behave in these ways, to bow down to these different gods, to serve these different things. If we want the crops, we need to do this for the Queen of Heaven. We need to get this help from Baal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And just the wicked, wicked, wicked carnality of it all. The fallacy, let's go back now to Jeremiah chapter 10, famous passage. Hear the word that the Lord speaks to you, O house of Israel. Thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the nation, nor be dismayed at the signs of the heavens, because the nations are dismayed at them. This is kind of like in Matthew 6 where Jesus is saying, be not like them. And of course, what have Israel and Judah been doing? They've been being like them. Don't be dismayed at the signs of heaven. You remember for the Egyptians, Ra, sails across the sky every day, and there's a snake chasing him. And every once in a while, the snake catches Ra and swallows him. That's the eclipse. So there, and they named the different gods and stuff and worshiping the host. Don't be like that. Learn not the way of this. Don't be dismayed at the signs of the heavens. The nations are dismayed at them. The customs of the people are vanity. A tree from the forest is cut down, worked with an axe by the hand of a craftsman. They decorate it with silver and gold. And by the way, a lot of the wooden idols, of course, we're not going to be able to find archaeologically the way you can find something in clay or stone or something like that, but there were plenty of these. A tree from the forest is cut down, worked with an axe by the hands of a craftsman. They decorate it with silver and gold. And you recall Isaiah in a similar passage talks about the fella, with part of the wood, he bakes his dinner, and with part of the wood, he makes into a god and worships it. Here, they decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with hammer and nails so that it cannot move. Your God is kind of limited when you have to nail him so that he doesn't fall over. Their idols are like scarecrows in a cucumber field. You've seen scarecrows. They cannot speak. They have to be carried, for they cannot walk. Do not be afraid of them. They cannot do evil, neither is it in them to do good. Years ago, Biblical Archaeology Review, letters to the editor thing, there was some preacher had written in and was canceling his subscription because they had had an article about an idol that had been found, and they told what the inscription was. And he said, you're unleashing demons, by printing what it said there. You just don't be afraid of them. They cannot do evil, neither is it in them to do good. The evil is that people were being distracted from serving God to this foolishness of worshiping these pagan idols and deities and these statues and such that they have made. There's none like you, O Lord. You are great, and your name is great and might. Who would not fear you, O King of the nations, for this is your due? For among the wise ones of the nations and all their kingdoms, there is none like you. They are both stupid and foolish. The instruction of idols is but wood. Beaten silver is brought from Tarshish, gold from Uphaz. They are the work of the craftsman, the hands of the goldsmith. Their clothing is violet and purple. They are the work of skilled men. But the Lord is the true God. Look at Romans chapter 1. You know this text. But it'll serve to help us start thinking about some other things. It says, the invisible things of God, back in verse 20, can be clearly seen by looking at what He made. If it snowed and a deer goes through your yard, you step out, you didn't see the deer, but you look at the tracks in the snow, and what do you know? You can clearly see the deer was there because you see what He made. But the Gentiles, though knowing God, they didn't honor Him as God. And they became fools. Their foolish hearts were darkened. Verse 22, claiming to be wise, they became fools, exchanged the glory of the immortal God for the images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up in the lust of their heart to impurity, to dishonoring their bodies among themselves. And here's our verse. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator. And that's a fundamental problem. So, here's a question. The God of the prophets, the God that the prophet Jeremiah and Isaiah that they're talking about, is one God, eternal, immortal, holy, and not to be reduced to any image. All around them, their neighbors are saying what? There's a bunch of gods. And they're not always that eternal or necessarily immortal. And very often, they're not very moral. And of course, they're worshiping idols. The question I want to ask you is this, as an evidentiary point in helping people understand and consider. Why did the Hebrew prophets have such a different message from everybody around them? Like, just on eternal or immortal. There might have been some that were considered eternal or immortal, but you look at different things. Like, let's take, I forgot his name, the Babylonian god. Is it Marduk? Okay, I was getting confused with the cartoon dog for a second. All right. Where did Marduk come from? Did he always exist? No. He came from his mother, Tiamat. Did Tiamat always exist? No. She was formed from sweet water and salt water mixing. By the way, a lot of evolutionary theory is not that far from a lot of paganism. Various ways. And then, so Tiamat has Marduk, and then there's a bunch of gods, and you have some of the gods that are afraid of Tiamat, and they don't want her to destroy them, and so they want to take out Tiamat. So they go to Marduk, and they say, you know, listen, would you kill your mom? You know, help us, because we don't want her to kill us. And being a good son, he says, what do I get out of it? You know, do I get to be chief god? And they're like, yes, you get to be chief god. So he captures her with a net, and he takes a sword, and he splits her in two like a fish. And then as he split her in two like a fish, she was a dragon or something, he noticed the beauty of the parts. And so with one part of it, he makes the heavens. And with another part, he made the earth. It's the type of thing like Iceland, the bards of Iceland and the up Norse and some like that. I may get some of these names wrong. But before there were any gods, before there was anything else, before there was the earth, there was this river. There was no earth, but there's this river flowing from an abyss somewhere. And it's going along, and you got these waters, and they eventually hit some ice, and the warm water starts melting it, and there's like the head of a giant. And was that when a sacred cow came and started licking it? I'm not sure. I can't remember. But finally, this giant comes out, and then out of his armpit comes a man and a woman, and then they kill the giant. And from his skull, they make the heavens. And from his bones, they make, I believe it was the stones and the mountains. From his hair, maybe it was the woods. from his blood, you know, becomes the sea and different things. And then, you know, you've got the different Greek myths. Zeus, when he marries Wisdom, somebody points out, and then he's about to have a child. Well, you kind of married a smart woman. that's going to be a very bright child. He's going to take over, you know, and so you got, what are you going to do about that? Well, he had a plan. He ate her, you know, before the baby's born. He eats her and thus digests her wisdom, which, you know, the nutritional value of the wisdom gave him a heads up on everybody else. And that also removed the threat. I think, was it Apollos that wanted to take advantage of his sister, so he turned into a bird, flies, lands on the ledge, and says, oh, it's a bird. Then he turns him to himself, takes... You look at the pagan views of God. As I said, they can have beginnings, they can have it. Ra gets old and senile, you know. Some of these gods can be killed, they can get old, they can have their what are their gods? Big us. There's a bunch of us. We have different jobs, butcher, baker, candlestick maker. And so there's a bunch of gods, and they have different jobs. War, you know, fertility, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we come into existence, they can come into existence, and after we come into existence, we fight and claw to take advantage of others and get on top. So what do? That's what they do. And they do bad things, we do bad things to others, so that's what they do to each other. So in the midst of, and they shouldn't have had these ideas. Romans said, points out that they could have seen, there's a God, but their foolish heart is darkened, but it was just so common. So in this sea of ignorance and these repeated patterns of just picturing the gods to be a bunch of them, like a bunch of us, fighting and clawing, deceiving, lying, killing, warring with each other, et cetera, et cetera. Why is the message of Moses and the prophets so very different? Somebody want to venture a guess? Other than the obvious one, if you're trying to talk to somebody about evidences, what might somebody suggest? Pardon? All right, and that's what we have the answer in the Bible, that they're saying, thus saith the Lord. If the creator of the universe selected Abraham and said, this is what I'm going to do for you, and he selects Moses, and he says, I will be your God, you'll be my people, and you, this is what you don't do. You don't worship other gods. You don't start worshiping images. Don't learn the ways of the nations through Jeremiah. That explains it. But if you're talking to me, and this is from an evidentiary point of view, if you're talking to an unbeliever, what possible explanation might they come up with?
They might come up
yes.
with what you're saying?
Yeah, how did the Israelites manage to have a more sophisticated view of God?
Something about their society as a whole.
Yeah, so it's like, well, the Egyptians, they were better at what? Engineering. The Greeks are better at what? Philosophy. Well, the Jews just happen to be really, really good at sophisticated. There's a problem with that. Jeremiah's giving this message to a people that what? They're wanting to be like everybody else. Now, granted, you did have among the Greeks, you did have philosophers who rejected the paganism and stuff. And they could have thought better than they did. And there were some people who thought Confucius over in China is doing better than some people in some ways. But I think it's a striking point to be made to get people to think about, look at the difference here. There are similarities. The common refrain we always hear from unbelievers, the Old Testament is merely what? It's just a myth, like all these other myths. Oh, are there some things similar? Do the other ones talk about supernatural events? Deities, priests, temples, sacrifices, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And you have some, you know, abnormal things that don't normally happen? Yes, but then you've also got these things. And for instance, if you've got a worldwide flood, that would explain why you would have a common reference to flood. But I think these are important points when we're dealing with people on an evidentiary level. And we're going to be needing to do that more and more as years go by. Another thing is that you've got commingled corruption. Remember the Samaritans after the Assyrians have taken away Israel, and they bring back some people from other nations and deposit them here, and they're having trouble with what animal?
Lions.
And so they say, well, we need to get a priest that knows about the God of this land. So they get a priest to come, and what does it say in 2 Kings 17? They feared the Lord, but also served their own gods. And that's what's going on also in Judah. Because they're still going to where? They're still going to the temple. they're still offering sacrifices and doing these other things. You know, making their cakes to the Queen of Heaven or sacrificing their children to Molech, etc. I remember years ago down in Haiti, Mike, we were down in Haiti together. Were you out there on the trip? I think it was a later trip. I was Terre Rouge, up in the north, and one night I can hear, it's just like a lot of them stick huts and that kind of thing, but one night you hear the boom, 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 boom. You know, it's the voodoo thing. I went out to, but they saw me or something, and it shut down. So I never saw a voodoo altar, but I was told that on their voodoo altars, they would often have like a picture of the Virgin Mary, which at first seemed really, really strange to me. If you're into, why? Well, and this is a voodoo altar. And of course you can see, like, here's a skull, but what do you see up there? I assume that's supposed to be Mary. What do you see right here? You see a cross. What do you see up there above that skull? You see a cross. Catholicism was, you know, had been prominent there, and voodoo had been prominent there, so what did they do? And it's not that unusual. I mean, let's take a look just there, the Catholic Virgin Mary. I mean, a lot of Catholicism was what? Taking some of the essence of the New Testament and taking paganism with it. You had pagans who were used to a Queen of Heaven or a Mother Goddess or something. And then you get this elevation of Mary. You had pagans worshiping all these idols. So the idols just have a job. He takes care of this, he takes care of this, he takes care of this. That got replaced with the saints, etc. So this co-mingling is something that has happened over and over and over. And, of course, if we're not careful, can that kind of thing happen with us today? It absolutely can. Jeremiah 11:10-12. So with their commingled worship, well, we're serving God of Israel, and we're serving, they got their bases covered. I got my sacrifices here. I got my fertility rites done to the Canaan, to Baal, which is a lot more interesting to me anyway because I'm debased. But they're going to have a problem. Though they cry to me, what's God say? I'm not going to listen. And so then who will they cry to? They're going to cry to their pagan idols, and they cannot save them. So they put themselves in a bind where the God who could do something won't listen. And the gods who they're asking to can do nothing. So some applications. Let's think about idolatry in a broader sense. Brianne was nannying for a family summer two ago, couple summers ago maybe, who, a couple of doctors, I don't remember if they were from India or Pakistan, I think India, yeah, India, yeah, wouldn't have been Pakistan. And these are both medical doctors, and there was a closet, you know, in the house where they had their little elephant god, you know, and there are people that still worship idols today. Most of us are not running into, you know, that many people worshiping stick and stone and wood idols today. But what do we have in Colossians chapter 3? Put to death, verse 5, therefore what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and what? Covetousness, which is idolatry. We're going to talk about the rich young ruler in just a minute. And what was his problem? Did he want to serve the Lord? But he also had what? He had something created that was more important to him, that he was more devoted to than the Lord. Let me go ahead and throw this out here. How many of you have had daughters or wives or yourselves ever worked in the fast food industry? Any of your wives, daughters, anything ever work as waitresses? Right? Did they tell you what hard work it was? When we're at home, I hope sometimes we help clear the table.
But if everybody else just goes away, is it a lot of fun to clear a table? No. I have a question. You don't have to answer this, but I want you to think about it. Did you leave a tip where we just were? And if you were, was it reflective of your appreciation of a person while we were sitting there enjoying food? Because, you know, waitresses don't get, they don't have to be paid minimum wage because it's counted on that they're what? That a lot of their income is going to be based on tips. And there's a lot of us, and I think a lot of us made a mess. And somebody was cleaning it up. When you left, did you do something to make sure that you were respecting and honoring that work? Or did you decide that you wanted your money to stay in your pocket? Covetousness is something we need to be concerned about. We're going to talk about that a little bit more in just a minute. I want to hit a couple other points first. Celebrities and entertainment. Oh, it's a TV show. As I saw in the news, the ratings are finally, I guess, on a downslide. But what was the name of it? American Idol. Grocery stores, there's a lot of marketing and design into what is placed where. The things on the end caps, that's kind of prime real estate. The things at the registers, that's really prime real estate. When you're going through the cereal aisle, the kiddie cereals are not way up at the top. You know, they place things for certain reasons. And on those magazines, how many of those magazines are about the lives of celebrities? Our society is just obsessed with celebrities. And sports figures. Now, if you've got kids at home, I'm letting my kids play some sports. I think it's real healthy. But if they start getting infatuated and intrigued by some sports figure or some band, and that's really what occupies their mind, and the posters in their room are about that, and their T-shirts are about that, and all their conversation is about that, but if you're talking about Jeremiah or Paul or something, there's just not much interest there. Or the Lord, there's not much interest there. What, do you see a similar problem to getting to this thing, serving the creature rather than the creator? Humanism. One of the statements of humanism is what? We have waited too long for a God to do what we could have done and should have done all along, which is about exalting who? Us. And religious allegiances. You remember in Acts chapter 20, Paul says, I know to the Ephesian elders, I know that after I leave, there's going to arise some wolves in sheep's clothing from among you, seeking to what? Speaking perverse things, seeking to do what? Draw away disciples after them. So many people are willing to follow other religious leaders instead of the Lord. Partly there's a laziness on people. A lot of people don't want to seek. A lot of people don't want to focus on the Lord. Religion is not that big a part of their life. But if they've got a little piece of religion pie that they want to include instead of letting God rule over all, then if they can find somewhere for somebody to just tell them what to do and what to believe and answer their questions for them, then that's good enough. Well, and there's people with really big egos that are happy to put themselves up in the Lord's shoes and find people that will serve them in that way. But also intellectually. You know, from time to time, has happened in the past, will happen in the future, there's going to be some book that comes along, right? And everybody's like, oh, this is the book. And this academic or this evangelical or this preacher or that person, they've written, oh, this is it. And people get so excited. You remember way back to like the Boston movement, before that, the Crossroads movement? Back down at the Crossroads congregation in Florida, there was one time when they were together and a guy was holding up that little, I guess it was that little paperback book, Master Plan, if you're familiar with it. And he said, this is it. This is the book. Well, when somebody's holding up a book and it's not the Word of God, they're saying, this is it, this is the book, there's a problem there. Going back to the rich young ruler, Jesus said what in Matthew chapter 6 about riches and God? You cannot serve. You cannot serve. You're going to have to put one first. You can't serve them both. And that's the situation with the rich young ruler. Mark 10 says he ran to Jesus. Ran to him. Fell on his knees before him. And said, good teacher, what shall I do? Was he interested? Yes. Was he acting respectful? Yes. Was he acting eager? Yes. And Jesus tells him, keep his commandments. Which ones? This one, too. Did it? Always done those. What else? Now, at this point, Peter and the apostles may be thinking, we might as well go home. This is like super disciple. You know, that's not how Peter got there and the other guys. You remember Peter, when the Lord brought up the fish, he said, Lord, just go away. I'm a sinful man. This guy's really, really good. And then Jesus says, there's one thing you lack. Now, Mike and Jeff were on the math team. I was not. But, you know, if I had a math test and I only got one wrong, happy camper. You know, I just got one wrong. Yeah, I consider that pretty good. Jesus says, you're only missing one thing. Jesus, Mark's account says Jesus loved him. He could see what was in his heart. He said, sell everything you've got. Give it to the poor and follow me. Now, you own a house? You own a car? Do you have any stocks? Do you have any savings? Tim, do you have a motorcycle? I'm with you on that. That shouldn't be counted. That should be excluded. That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. So that doesn't count. But seriously, would we give away everything we own if the Lord asked us to? Why did the Lord ask? Lord didn't ask that of everybody. He didn't ask Zacchaeus to do it. Zacchaeus didn't have a heart where he was putting money above the Lord. The rich young ruler was. And that's what Jesus required of him. If he asked that of you, if he asked that of me, would we do it? If we wouldn't, then we've got exactly the same problem as the rich young ruler. And the fact that we didn't walk up and ask him, what do we lack still yet, doesn't change the fact that that's our problem. And Luke 14, not just things, he said what? If you love wife, son, daughter, or your life, more than me. Well, in Luke, it's the if you hate, but it corresponded to the Matthew 10 passage. He says, you what? He said, you won't be the best disciple? He said, what? You cannot be my disciple. 2 Corinthians, let's close with this. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. The same group of people who you recall in the first epistle were trying to justify, even though they didn't believe in idols, they wanted to justify going down and taking place in part of idolatry that was appealing to them. Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers, for what partnership has righteousness with lawlessness? What fellowship has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial? What portion does a believer share with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? Remember back again to Luke chapter 14? If you're going to build a tower, don't build it unless you have what it takes to finish it. You're not going to go to war if you don't have a commitment, enough troops that you're going to do it. We have to have the willingness and the ability to renounce all to follow the Lord. And he says, salt that's not salty, what is it good for? And a Christian that doesn't put Christ first, that's this unsalty salt. There's no point in it. What fellowship has light with darkness? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? We are a temple of the living God. I will make my dwelling among them and walk among them. I will be their God. They shall be my people. Therefore, go out from their midst, separate from them, says the Lord. touch no unclean thing, then I will welcome you, and I will be a father to you, and you will be sons and daughters to me, says the Lord Almighty. And of course, what does Joshua say? He says, if you want to go serve some pagan god, which pick your pagan god that you're going to follow. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Thank you.